Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, some words of great wisdom from Noam Chomsky. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week, we have a rare and impressive interview with America's most distinguished public intellectual, Noam Chomsky. Well, it's technically an interview, but the interviewer was wise enough to ask a quick question and then let Chomsky talk uninterrupted for 7 or 8 minutes. The interviewer is Guy Evans, who was host of an interesting podcast called Smells Like Human Spirit. That podcast seems to have ended in 2015. Today's words were recorded in Chomsky's office in Cambridge, Mass, on November 20, 2012. It's striking, but not surprising, how relevant Chomsky's remarks are 7 years later, as very little in the world has changed since then. Chomsky addresses three main questions. 1. How does oppression work in free societies such as ours? The short answer to that is through propaganda and advertising. Question 2. How does activism today differ from that of the 1960s? And question 3. What issues are most pressing for today's younger generation? I've had to condense the interview a tad to fit our time slot. From 2012, here is Noam Chomsky.
How does oppression work in Western countries, notably the United States?
It's interesting to look at the history. For the last, say, century and a half or so, the freest countries were England and the United States. And in both countries, by about a century ago, dominant sectors, power centers, came to the realization, which was pretty explicit, in fact, and articulate, that it's becoming difficult to control people by force. They've just won too much freedom. So there were parliamentary labor parties, there were unions, women were about to get the right to vote, the U.S. 1920s, and there was a lot of ferment, and people were just able to become directly engaged in the political arena to an extent that hadn't been true before. But since it was necessary to keep them under control, it was necessary to turn to other means. And the other means were the obvious ones, control of attitudes and opinions. Out of that came the huge public relations industry, which was advertising and the rest, which is an extraordinarily huge industry now, and was explicitly designed to carry out that task. So if you read the founding documents of the PR industry, for example, well, the most interesting is the book Propaganda. They used the term honestly in those days. Since the Second World War, it took on a bad connotation, so they don't use it. But they called it propaganda. And the guru of the industry, Edward Bernays, was the author. He had experience. He came out of Woodrow Wilson's Committee on Public Information, which of course means disinformation. And it was Wilson had to drive the pacifist American public into a spirit of jingoism and fanaticism and hatred of everything German so that they would join the war. And that was tricky. He was elected in 1916 on a pacifist program. No peace without victory, and he quickly had to do something to get the U.S. into the war. And this commission, the Creel Commission, was dedicated to that task, and it was remarkably successful. And the people who were on it learned lessons. One of them was Bernays. Another was Walter Lippmann, who was became the leading public intellectual of the 20th century in the United States, a very distinguished figure, also a theorist of democracy. And both of them do essentially the same lesson, that, as they put it, obviously the intelligent minorities, as they call them, have to rule. That's us and our friends. And the rest of the population are, as they put it, too stupid and ignorant to be able to allow them to enter into the management of public affairs. It would be like, you know, allowing a three-year-old to cross the street and so on. So for their own benefit, we have to find ways to marginalize and control them. We have to provide them with what Reinhold Niebuhr called necessary illusions and emotionally potent oversimplifications. We have to defend ourselves from the roar and trampling of the bewildered herd, the ignorant and meddlesome outsider. These are all quotes, these standard views. And it's all basically the same view. We're very benevolent, and we want to take care of the public, and they obviously can't do it themselves, or they get in trouble. So therefore we have to somehow marginalize them. And that's what the you look at the business literature of the period, it talked about how it's necessary to focus people on the superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption. And of course, you know, kind of atomize them, break up groupings. So the ideal unit will end up being you and your television set or something like that. And this just then turns into a huge industry. The advertising industry itself, which is enormous, is actually quite interesting if you look at it closely. It has a very definite commitment. I mean, its primary goal, its primary involvement is commercial advertising. And incidentally, its success in commercial advertising, even by the 1920s, impressed many others. So, for example, Goebbels explicitly modeled Nazi propaganda techniques on the methods of American commercial advertising, which he realized were quite effective. But if you think of the general goal of commercial advertising, its primary goal is to undermine markets. That's never discussed this way, but if you think about it, it's pretty obvious. If you've taken an economics course, say, you know that markets are supposed to be based on informed consumers making rational choices. And on the basis of that assumption, you prove various nice theorems and so on and so forth. But if you turn on a television set, you see in 1 minute that the goal of advertising is to create uninformed consumers making irrational choices.
Absolutely.
And in fact, that's the obvious thrust of advertising. And it has a political significance, too. Overwhelmingly over the years, much more so in the United States than other countries, though it's seeping in everywhere, the electoral campaigns are being run by the advertising industry. In the United States, it's just overwhelming. You know, the ads, framing, you know, the way you present personalities, and the whole business is designed by the advertising industry, and they know it. And so, for example, after the 2008 campaign, Obama's victory in 2008, a couple of months later, the advertising industry had its annual convention, and every year they give an award for the best marketing campaign. That year they gave it to Obama. Terrific marketing campaign. You know, managed to delude everyone, you know, with crazy talk.
Change.
Yeah, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And in fact, then you look at the business press, Financial Times had a wonderful article in which they were, I don't know if it was intended to be ironic or not, they were quoting CEOs and others who were really euphoric about the success. This is a new model for how to project ourselves. We used to use the Reagan model, but now we can start using this model. But it's all just advertising. And what they're doing is carrying over from their commitment to undermine markets, carrying that over to a commitment to undermine democracy. You take a look at the American electoral campaign that just past or any other. The goal is to create uninformed voters who will make irrational choices. That is to undermine, you know, what you're taught in school is democracy, but Lippmann and others knew better. Democracy understood as a danger. You have to keep the people out of things, and this is one of the ways to keep them out of it. And it works. So, for example, if you, there, political science literature has some very good, there's very good work done in academic political science on particular topics. Among one of the main ones is study of attitudes and policy. So a lot of very good work. The kind of gold standard right now is a book that just appeared, which Influence and Affluence, it's called, which it does a detailed study of how public attitudes and public policy correlate. And what it concludes is, and I think pretty well establishes, that's that if you just take income levels, the bottom 70% have no influence whatsoever on policy. So they're effectively disenfranchised. And as you move up the income level, you get somewhat more influence. When you get to the very top, basically, they get what they want. Mm. So what they're describing is a traditional plutocracy. Mm. And the goal of the commercial advertising and the advertising industry is to just ensure that it works. And it's all for the good of the public, just the total benevolence.
Right.
The rationale is developed by the leading intellectuals, by top figures in the industry and so on. It makes perfectly good sense. Mm. If you can't control people by force, you've got to control them in some other way, and there aren't a lot of other ways. Mm. This is the obvious way.
How would you compare the tone of what was going on in the 1960s to now?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of illusions about the 60s. Okay. The 60s were mostly pretty quiescent. There was an upsurge in the early 60s about the civil rights movement. But remember that that was somewhere else. That was Alabama, Georgia, and so on. There's a lot of excitement about it. Mm-hmm. What's less remembered is that that didn't end the effort of the civil rights movement. It just ended its successes. So when you listen to the speeches on Martin Luther King Day, Martin King is now a hero. In retrospect, he wasn't at the time. He was vilified. But they typically end with his I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington, and that's the culmination of all our hopes. King didn't stop there. He immediately went on. He went to the North, began working on urban poverty. He started trying to develop a popular movement of the poor to press for class issues, class demands. He moved to the, and as soon as he moved in that direction, he was cut off. The Northern liberals were quite happy to have him condemn racist Alabama sheriffs, but leave us alone, you know. Hmm. And racism in the North is extreme, shows up in all kind of ways, and it interlinks with oppression of the poor. So as soon as you turn to class issues, you're in trouble, because you're running into major interests. Mm. If you look at the rest of Martin Luther King's career, he was killed in 1968. He also started criticizing the Vietnam War. Contrary to much manufactured illusion, the intellectual classes strongly supported the war, including the liberal Democrats, who later claimed that they were always opposed to it. But the record is very clear, because these are articulate people, so they write, you can see what they wrote. And that already cast a shadow over King, but turning to the class issue was even worse. He was finally killed in Memphis, Tennessee. He was there to support a public worker strike, just the people who are being vilified now, sanitation workers. And he gave another I Have a Dream speech there. Quite an eloquent one, but pretty hard to find. He used his biblical rhetorical style, and he described himself as like Moses, you know, standing on a mountain. He can see the promised land. He realizes he'll never get there, but if we struggle on, you can get there. And then he was assassinated almost immediately. He was about to lead a march to Washington to petition Congress for rights for the poor. This is part of his poor people's movement. Well, his wife, Coretta King, led the march, and they went through the main places in the South where there had been major struggles, you know, Selma and others, and they made it to Washington. They set up a tent city, like Occupy, a resurrection city. This is the most liberal Congress in American history. They let them stay there for a while. Then they sent in the police in the middle of the night and tore it to shreds and drove them out of town. And that was the end of the poor people's movement. So the civil rights movement had its successes, important, very important ones, but limited, was focused. Well, what about the anti-war movement? That was pretty slow in coming. I mean, Kennedy launched the war in 1961-62, sent the American Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam, authorized napalm, which was described as something that really terrifies the gooks, you know, should use that, launched crop destruction programs, chemical warfare to destroy crops and ground cover, started programs to round people up and drive them into what amounted to concentration camps. They called strategic hamlets. Mm-hmm. We'd call that war if anybody else did it.
Sure.
There was no opposition. I mean, I was trying to give talks about the war at the time. It was comical. I'd sometimes be able to give a talk in someone's living room with a couple of neighbors, but things like that. It was, I mean, it was years before anything developed. But by about 67, 66, 67, yeah, there was large-scale opposition. Though still denounced by the majority of the educated sectors, it was beginning to seep in, but not much. I mean, I could give you details if you like. It's pretty interesting. Anyhow, there was a period, roughly 68 to maybe 71, that period, in which there was extensive anti-war activism, demonstrations. When Nixon invaded Cambodia in 1970, the colleges were closed down. Delegations of elite intellectuals were going to Washington to tell them to stop destroying our country, and business leaders turned against the war and so on. So there was that brief period. And then that activism declined, though the war continued. Mm-hmm. For example, some of the worst periods of the war were right then, when early 70s, the United States was bombing. Late 60s, but primarily early 70s, the U.S. was intensively bombing northern Laos and rural Cambodia. And that was a real horror story. I mean, in this is now Henry Kissinger. He transmitted to the General Haig Nixon's orders, which in his words were Cambodia, anything that flies against anything that moves. You know, it's one of the most articulate calls for genocide in the archival record. That was, I think, 1970. And after that came bombing of rural Cambodia. You know, it's like poor rural communities at a level of intensity that was had no parallel anywhere. The closest was northern Laos just before. And it converted the Khmer Rouge, who were a marching force at the time, into a huge army of enraged peasants. And we know what happened afterwards. Well, there's a lot of talk about what happened afterwards, but what about what happened before that created it? No protest, virtually no protest, a little protest at the time, virtually none, and in retrospect, it's been wiped out, so it's not part of history. That's the anti-war movement. However, it remained, and it's continued. In fact, right through the 70s, activism continued. It wasn't as visible as it in those few years, but it was there. And in fact, some of the most important movements with really lasting effects are from the 70s. The feminist movement, for example, had its roots in the 60s, kind of beginning. And as usual, vilified, you know, brow-burning, the crazy women, that sort of thing. But by the 70s, it had become a major movement. By now, it's just changed the country enormously. The environmental movement began around 1970, and incidentally, Nixon was one of the people who helped support it. The country has changed so much that today the Republicans are trying to dismantle Nixon's environmental efforts. By today's standards, Nixon would be considered a radical leftist or something. It tells you something about what's happened to the country.
Yeah.
But the movement continued. Anti-nuclear movement continued. By the early 80s, it was an enormous movement. It compelled Reagan to move into the Star Wars fantasies to try to shut it up. And it just continues on. The global justice movements, which are the solidarity movements for Central America in the 1980s, have absolutely no historical parallel. There's never been a moment in the history of imperialism, Western imperialism, in which large numbers of people from the imperial power not only protested ongoing atrocities, but went to live with the victims. Nobody ever thought of that
no.
in any earlier period, but it was happening all over in the 80s. And it wasn't Eastern colleges. It was Midwest Americans, rural areas, evangelical Christians, all over the main part of the country. That's a phenomenal development, never anything like it. That's the 80s. It's not called the history of activism, but that's because of the way intellectuals write history. It's not because of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it continues on, the global justice movement, so it was really the last 10 years or so, and they're quite substantial. So I think it's not the usual picture, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Occupy was quite important, I think, but I don't think you can say it somehow sprung out of nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. With all that being said, for this particular generation, what do you feel are the most important issues for them to focus their energies on?
Well, there are two issues which are of transcendental importance because they have to do with species survival. Now, we live in a unique moment of human history. Humans have been around for maybe 100,000 years, and we've gotten to the point where we can now destroy the species and most other species. And we're on the verge of doing it. That's not remote. Two aspects. One is environmental catastrophe. I mean, you know, if you're a Republican congressman or Mitt Romney, you can deny that it's happening. But as the business press says recently, that's insane. You know, yes. It's very calculated insanity. That means we want our short-term profits and we don't give a damn what happens to our grandchildren.
Profit over people.
That's basically what it amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of pathological stance, but very widespread.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the impact. What we don't do now or what we do now is going to have very significant impact not too far in the future. That's one. The other is nuclear war. We've managed to survive since 1945, but it's kind of a miracle. In fact, right now, happens to be that we just passed the 50th anniversary of what historians call the most dangerous moment in human history, correctly. It's the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I think that's been pretty seriously misinterpreted. But it's important to think through what actually happened. Came very close to war that would have, say, wouldn't have killed everybody, but would have had a devastating impact. And by now it's known that in a first strike, if there was a first strike with a great power, it would destroy the victim, but it would also destroy those who were launching the strike, because it would lead to nuclear winter and all sorts of other horrible effects. And it came very close. We were basically saved from it by Khrushchev's sanity. I mean, go through the details if you like, but that's, you know, I the standard view, Kennedy's finest moment, I think it's one of the lowest moments of human history I can talk about. But that's very live. In fact, we're building up to another conflagration right now. Just take a look at the Persian Gulf. The U.S. has enough destructive capacity in the Gulf, naval vessels and so on, to destroy the species 100 times over. That's a piece of it. There's also the huge destructive forces going from the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean, all focused mainly right now on Iran. The interesting question is what it's for. We could talk about that, but it's pretty clear that it's even an accident could set something up off, and there have been a couple of accidents. Wars have started that way, and we don't know where it would go. And interestingly, there's a very straightforward way of dealing with it, very straightforward. But thanks to the internalized system of imposing necessary illusions, it's not being discussed, very straightforward way. First of all, most of the world doesn't regard Iran as a particular threat. That's a Western obsession. But let's agree, let's say it's a threat, whatever the threat may be. How do you deal with it? Well, the simplest way would be to move towards establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region with inspections. Well, it turns out almost universal support for that, including Iran. but there's a barrier. The United States won't permit it. The United States and Israel, but Israel is not an independent actor. They can do what the U.S. permits. Their position is, it was restated by Obama recently, that it's a wonderful idea, but not now. And it has to exclude Israel, and it can't be entertained until Israel's right to exist and permanent peace is guaranteed. Well, that can't happen. Nobody's right to exist is even demanded except for Israel, and certainly can't be guaranteed. And besides, we can continue to put off a peaceful settlement forever, as we've been doing for 35 years. So essentially, no nuclear weapons-free zone. This is very imminent. There's an international conference coming up in Helsinki in December to try to carry forward this effort. Okay, now it's an exercise for you. Do a database search in the American press and see how many references you can find to it. I'll tell you what you'll find. Nothing. Maybe a word here and there, like the Chicago Tribune had about 5 lines on a Reuters report. But effectively, nobody knows about it. If nobody knows about it, there can't be any pressure to get the United States to participate seriously. Therefore, there can't be any steps towards a very straightforward settlement, at least reduction of whatever anybody thinks the Iranian threat is. Well, that's a pretty impressive case of, you know, what Walter Lippmann called manufacturing consent, ensuring that the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders don't interfere with our affairs because they can't even hear about it. That, you know, there's no government pressure and there's no conspiracy. This is just internalized, which maybe goes back to your original question. How does it work in free societies? Well, it works by indoctrination that is so profound that it's completely internalized and not even perceived.
Noam Chomsky with some brilliant impromptu observations from 2012. That's from the now-defunct podcast Smells Like Human Spirit, unearthed from the bowels of my external hard drive. And from the bowels of darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non carborundum, and please tune in again next week. Peace.